Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Before we get started with today's episode, I just wanted to make a quick announcement on behalf of one of our friends here at the podcast, and that's where I work, the University of Kentucky. The Department of Anesthesiology Critical Care Division is hosting a webinar for anybody who's interested in a good ICU job. So if you're looking for a advanced practice position in surgical, neuro, cardiac, critical care, come check it out. It's going to be November 20th at 4 p.m. Eastern. There's going to be a webinar where you're going to hear from the department leadership, learn about different training pathways, and discover how you can be part of a really great team at the ICU at the University of Kentucky. I will have a link in the show notes, so come check it out. Now on to the show.
Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative, storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the podcast. Brian Bowling back with you as usual, and joining me is my partner in crime, Brandon Odo. We are going to be talking about something today that probably a lot of us don't have a ton of hands-on experience with, and that is burn critical care. So this is a very specialized sort of area of critical care, and really, I guess, a subset of trauma critical care. But we figured we better have somebody on who knows a little bit more than we do. So we got Clint Leonard with us today. Clint is an NP in the Vanderbilt Burn ICU down in Nashville, Tennessee. He's also an instructor for ABLS, which is the Advanced Burn Life Support. If you know anything about ATLS for trauma or ACLS for cardiac, this is the burn version of that. And even more so than that, he's developed courses for first responders all over the place, including U.S. Army medics, firefighters, the National Fire Academy of Guatemala, and so forth. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much.
All right, Clint. So you're just going to give us kind of a general 101 review of what goes on in the burn ICU, because I think probably 90% of the audience has never set foot in such a place, if they even have one in their center, which many hospitals don't. I mean, this is like the ultimate example of regionalization of specialties, because there aren't that many burn ICU or burn centers in general. So they're only here and there. I mean, I guess there's not that many burn patients. That's the reason. But most of us don't have any experience with this. I have very little. I rotated through the burn unit when I was a resident, but that was about it. But I found it to be just kind of a fascinating example of how things differ between types of ICUs and how it can still kind of inform what we do in even other sorts of units. So let's just chat about some generalities. You work in a burn ICU, and of course, you can see burn patients outside of the critical care setting. There could be sort of, quote, floor-level burn patients, but that'll be another matter. When you get patients who come to you, what sorts of problems do they generally have? Meaning, how did they land in your lap? What is a common, cause of burns that would, lead someone to you?
So there's different ways of breaking it down, but maybe the most intuitive is just the mechanism of injury. So we know that about 40% of burn injuries are going to be flame burns. 30% or so will be scald burns, usually water, of course, but also grease, especially down here in the South. That's a very common mechanism. And then you have a scattering of things like electrical injury, chemical injury. We also see a lot of smoking on oxygen. That's actually about 5% of our burns. But those are kind of the broad categories, some contact burns as well. But those are the things that bring people into the ICU. Now, generally, the people that have the largest surface area burns are going to be flame burns, usually structure fire, whether that's a house fire or a car fire.
Sure. I mean, if someone spills their hot tea on their lap or something, that's probably less likely to be an ICU problem, unless you, I'm trying to imagine some bizarre scenario where you burned your whole body in, hot water. But, anything is possible. But, and do you get, I feel like it's not an uncommon thing in some burn centers to see patients who don't, aren't actually burned, but have like wide scale, like desquamating skin diseases like Stevens-Johnson. You guys get those as well?
Absolutely. It differs a little with each burn center and kind of how they've negotiated with their institution. But Stevens-Johnson is a cornerstone of what we do. Some places take the, you know, bullous desquamating disorders, definitely.
And that's really just because you guys have the skill set and resources to manage really big wounds like that, right? I mean, it's obviously not a burn, but it's, some of the care is similar, and it's like a bit much for someone outside that setting to deal with the like the wound care and dressings and that sort of thing.
Exactly. And some of the pitfalls you run into, like the fluid losses from having that much open skin, are very similar. So I think we're a little more attuned sometimes to the dangers of something like Stevens-Johnson.
Is that like, you know, everyone has admissions they're sort of gripe about. Is that like not your favorite thing? Like you kind of wish that was not part of what you had to do, but is...
You said it. They are incredibly challenging. So the hardest part I find is that you've got this patient that has been on a variety of medications for a number of comorbidities. So anti-epileptic drugs are classic for causing Stevens-Johnson syndrome. So we work closely with dermatology, and their consult note invariably says, let's stop all their anti-epileptic medications. So you now have a patient who's got possibly 70, 80% cutaneous involvement, a longstanding seizure disorder, and you've just stopped all their anti-epileptics. So it definitely feels very tenuous. Or whether they just started, you know, a fifth generation cephalosporin for some infection, and all of a sudden ID says, well, we can't use that one anymore. They definitely come with a lot more baggage, so to speak, than your average burn patient.
Now you've got a seizing burn patient with no skin who can't have antibiotics. It's like the medicine of SICU patients.
Exactly.
Okay, so those are the reasons people end up with burns. But what is an indication to come to the burn ICU? I mean, is there a fairly specific set of criteria you guys use? I would imagine anyone who's obviously critically ill, but what reasons do those tend to be? Or are there cases where, you know, their vitals are stable and they're breathing and so on, but there are certain kind of anatomic criteria where you guys are like, this should come to the unit?
So I think generally speaking, like any other ICU, hemodynamic instability is going to be the main reason you end up there. And generally, that's going to start once you get above a 20% TBSA burn, a total body surface area burn. We know that you start to see systemic inflammatory signs at that 20% mark. Now, certainly that varies based on the patient's pre-existing demographics, but generally 20% is a good rule of thumb. So just automatically, anybody that's got a 20% burn is going to spend at least a few days in the burn ICU getting resuscitated for those fluid shifts. The other huge category that we see very commonly is patients with inhalation injury. Now, this can certainly happen in the absence of cutaneous burns, but anybody that's got an inhalation injury needs to be in the burn ICU. A lot of times they'll come to us already intubated. Sometimes they'll come to us just as an airway watch for 12 to 24 hours, depending on how reactive their airway is. I would say those are probably the two big cornerstones. And as you alluded to, there's also nursing indications. So anytime somebody has large burns, or, you know, a very common patient population we see is patients with pre-existing substance use disorder. So pain control is even more difficult than it would be in the average burn patient. Frequently have to have people on Presidex drips or ketamine drips, what have you, just for pain control, especially if they're not opioid or, you know, polysubstance naive.
As I mentioned, burn care is so regional. Is a large, maybe a majority of the patients you see transfers from other centers because they need to come to the burn unit?
Definitely. I think there's an element of fear when dealing with burn patients. So a lot of the smaller outlying hospitals will send their patients to us as soon as they see that they have any degree of burns. The American Burn Association does release referral criteria. So there are some very standardized benchmarks for when a patient would warrant, especially inpatient transfer. But we do serve a very large catchment area, and the majority of the burns that we see have already been kind of digested by the healthcare system further down the line.
So let's imagine you know, a fairly typical big burn, you know, maybe a house fire, someone with, I don't know, 70-80% body surface area burns. They turned up at the ED and then they came to you. What is kind of an initial, you know, handful of hours, maybe the first day of care usually look like? What's that initial resuscitation and in general, you know, getting ahead of problems look like in the burn unit?
So much of what we do is aiming for that Goldilocks of good fluid resuscitation. So the patient that comes in that is experiencing burn shock is a progressive, gradual process. So the first thing we want to do is start replacing the fluid that the patient is losing. Now, one of the common misconceptions and one of the misconceptions that I had when I first started was that the majority of the fluid losses were insensible losses that were, you know, migrating across the skin and into the bed sheet, so to speak. But the bigger thing we deal with is actually just the systemic inflammatory problem where you have third spacing, similar to any other patient with distributive shock. They act much more like a distributive shock patient than like a classic hypovolemic blood loss shock patient, for instance. So we want to give the amount of fluid that the patient needs, but we know that past a certain point, all we're going to be doing is exacerbating those hydrostatic pressures and just pushing more fluid into the third space. So in order to accomplish that, we want to have a very carefully titrated fluid resuscitation. So I think what most people are familiar with from school is just the Parkland formula, you know, that calculation where you give basically 4 mL per percent of the body burned per kilogram, and then you divide that with half going in the first 8 hours and then the other half going over the subsequent 16 hours. But what we found, I mean, what a surprise, is that just generating one number the first time you meet the patient and then running that for 24 hours doesn't lead to great outcomes. So almost every burn center now is going to titrate fluid based on the patient's response to fluid resuscitation. Now, a question that we all wrestle with every day as critical care practitioners is, how do I tell if my patient is adequately resuscitated, right? So obviously we're going to follow things like lactate, but that's kind of a trailing indicator for us. So generally we look at urine output. I always think of urine output is the cleanest shirt in the dirty clothes hamper because it's not a perfect number and there's so many confounding variables. Certainly the patient with CKD is going to confound you right off the bat. The patient that we frequently see who comes in after a night of drinking, so they've got a lot of ETOH circulating around and they're falsely diuresing, that will confound us as well. But generally what we found is that urine output is the most useful indicator for whether the patient is fluid resuscitated adequately. So we are tracking urine output hour by hour, trying to make sure that we're meeting the patient's fluid needs, but not over-resuscitating them, because we know that over-resuscitation is going to lead to a number of bad outcomes as well, even just in terms of making these burns worsen from second degree to third degree due to the amount of edema. So fluid resuscitation, definitely the cornerstone of that first 24 hours. And it's a lot more careful now than it was in the past.
Yeah, it's so interesting because so much of critical care and these pendulums go back and forth has started to move away from you know, big volumes of fluid resuscitation. Because in so many other settings, there's just not that much bang for your buck in someone who's not, like, you know, massively bleeding or something. And the harms are more and more apparent. But this is obviously a case where it's like the most extreme example. I mean, with like a big burn would just die if you didn't give them a lot of fluids. I mean, that's just sort of, that's how it is. You can't just put them on a little bit of a vasopressor or something. It's not a septic person. I mean, how much fluid do these people usually end up getting? Let's, you know, someone with 80% BSA burns or something. What's the kind of fluid regimen often looking like?
Sometimes dozens of liters. So just from this last week, we had someone with a 40% burn, and by 3 or 4 days in, they were 15 liters positive, which, you know, then has negative issues in those following days, but you're kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul. And it's, you're absolutely right that, you know, the pendulum has shifted. I don't feel so old, but I remember even in my career in the early days, I remember bedside celiotomies working as a nurse in the SICU because we would just so thoroughly fluid resuscitate patients. So we have definitely minimize the number of celiotomies we have to do.
Well, right. And I mean, yeah, it's perhaps affected you guys too. I mean, you may be doing less fluid than you did 10 years ago, but it's still probably more than anybody else. And I guess we should say, you know, the patient who's 15, 20 liters positive on paper, some of that fluid is, you know, in the bed or in the linens, right? It's maybe harder to quantify these people's fluid balance than, I don't know, maybe anyone else in the hospital.
Definitely. And the other thing we see, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning, we do live kind of downstream from trauma. So lower fluid resuscitation volumes have been part of that movement. The other thing we've really seen is using a lot of FFP to mitigate the endotheliopathy of trauma. And we've had a lot of success with colloid resuscitation in addition to just crystalloid, reducing the overall amount of volume needed to get these patients to a happy place hemodynamically.
Right. Now, do a lot of these patients end up intubated, let's say even in the absence of a direct airway injury like inhalation? It's just sort of hard to imagine someone who's this sick just kind of chilling out in bed talking to you. I mean, is it kind of typical that they end up on the vent and kind of with the full package of things as you go about the fluid resuscitation and everything else?
Definitely, for a variety of reasons. So one, a lot of times these do co-occur with inhalation injuries, so those patients are all going to have the ET tube placed early. The other is just pain control. It can be difficult to manage pain with the amount of medications we need without having a safe airway. And then the other consideration, which may not be as obvious, is that most of these patients are going to go to the OR multiple times over the first week that they're there. One of the best ways to mitigate the inflammatory response is just to excise all the dead tissue that's driving the response. So these patients are going to get, you know, 20% of their burned tissue taken off at a time. So if a patient has 60% burns, you're talking about at least three trips to the OR in that first week. And our goal is to have everything excised within the first 96 hours or so.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's at least talk briefly about the surgical side. So the general arc of this is dead tissue needs to get cut off. And as you're saying, do it early-ish, although perhaps in a somewhat staged fashion, not necessarily all at once. And then maybe some process of grafting we can talk about. How soon do you start that? I mean, they rush in and then in the first 5 hours, they're off in the OR, or resuscitate and stabilize them and maybe the next day, or?
Generally, what we see is that patients do better if we can fluid resuscitate them before rushing them to the OR. So the patients will generally get at least 24, usually closer to 48 hours of resuscitation before they're really ready to go to the operating room. And part of that is also because burn injuries tend to evolve a bit after they first happen. So if you were taking the patient immediately, you may feel that some tissue is dead, some tissue is salvageable. And then 48 hours in, you might have a different idea of which is which. This kind of gets back to the Jackson zones of injury that most people are probably familiar with from textbooks as well. The only real surgical emergency and burns that we tend to run into is escharotomies or fasciotomies. And most of the time, those are performed at the bedside. So these patients generally aren't going to the operating room until 48 hours.
So one part of the initial resuscitation, if you have, you know, circumferential burns and such, might be fasciotomies, escharotomies, to make sure you're not having compartment syndromes or respiratory compromise.
Exactly.
Do most of these patients end up needing lines, central lines, arterial lines?
Early on, the larger TBSA burns generally do. After the first week or so, because infection is such a big part of what we deal with, we very quickly work to get the at least big triple lumens out. Most of the time, patients will end up needing at least a PIC, especially if they're going to be, you know, in the hospital for 2 or 3 months. But central lines are just such a nexus of infection for us that we really do everything we can. And we're really blessed by our nurses being so amazing at ultrasound-guided IVs. I mean, most of the time, the providers don't even have to get involved. The PIC team doesn't have to get involved. The nurses on the burn unit are just such resources, even for the rest of the hospital, in terms of getting great IVs in places that I would never even dream of.
Right. The patient has like 6 inches of skin left, and that's where you can find an IV.
The dialysis patient that has 6 inches worth of skin and they get an IV.
Well, I mean, I don't have to dwell on this, but I mean, are you guys willing to put lines, whether peripheral or central or whatever, through non-intact skin? I mean, do you need skin to access a vessel?
We'll definitely go through burned skin. I mean, it's last resort, but when you have patients who have 80% burns, a lot of times you have to go through some burn tissue.
And so first part of the surgical care is excision, and then after that it's about grafting, right? And trying to get them some skin again. What does that process look like just in general?
So especially in the larger body surface area burns, the problem is it is relatively easy to excise. It is much harder to get good skin coverage. So to go back to the extreme case of the 80% burn, you've excised 80% of their skin. So at a theoretical maximum, you would only have 20% skin left to graft from, right? And it's not like the patient is going to preferentially spare all the best places to harvest skin from. So tops of the thighs, back, stomach, these are places that are easy to harvest from. Unfortunately, the places that are usually spared are not really. Yeah. So you've got this patient that's entirely excised. So they're just an open wound at that point. So we have to do something to kind of mitigate the fluid losses, to mitigate the risk of infection. And right now, what that looks like is generally cadaver skin. There are a ton of companies that want to generate entirely synthetic skin. We're not quite there yet. I don't know of anybody that's using that in practice regularly. We've got some dermal substitutes, but we have to get some sort of coverage on the patient. And usually that's just going to be donated cadaveric skin. So as soon as they excise, they can start putting the cadaver skin on. And then that acts as a temporary coverage to bridge you until you can get coverage with your own skin. Because ultimately, and this is the question the patients always ask, is can't you just donate skin from one person to another? But just like any allotransplantation, at some point, rejection will start to be an issue. Fortunately for skin, you can get 2 weeks out of it, potentially 3 weeks out of it before that starts to be an issue, but it's just not definitive treatment.
So cadaver skin is basically just like a medium-term dressing.
Exactly.
It's not, no one's walking around out there with like donor transplant skin like they are with a transplanted kidney or something.
This is so in the weeds, but there are some case reports of patients who are already on immunosuppressants because they have a donated kidney. And then they have a wound that they're able to put in cadaver skin and it works well. But generally for the average patient, no, it is what we call a biological Band-Aid when we're explaining it to families. It's temporary, but not definitive.
So then the long-term goal is to use the patient's own skin. And I'm just going to ask the obvious question. If a patient only has 20% intact skin and you cut off 10% of it and move it somewhere else, don't they still only have 20% skin, you've just shifted around what they have?
Yes, and there's three big strategies you can use. So the first thing is donor sites can be reharvested. So the amount of skin they take is actually so minuscule. They set the dermatome to 10,000ths of an inch. So the donor sites will actually heal within a week or two. There is an upper limit to how many times that you can harvest from a single donor site, but in these large surface area burns, we're obliged to get skin from the same donor sites again and again. The other thing that we do to help with this problem is we run it through a mesher. So if you've ever seen the picture of autografts of patient skin grafts and you notice that there's kind of a peculiar texture to it, a lot of times that's because we have to run it through a mesher. So in smaller burns, we'll do a 1-to-1 mesh or a 2-to-1 mesh because you get a little better cosmetic outcome from that. But in these large burns, you're looking at a 4-to-1 mesh, 5-to-1 mesh, you know, even in extreme cases, 6-to-1 mesh, although that's really pushing it. So you're getting a lot of surface area from a relatively small portion of skin. Now, interestingly, in the last few years, they developed autologous spray skin, which is basically you use an enzyme to denature the skin graft. You denature it to the point that it's just individual keratinocytes, individual fibroblasts, individual melanocytes, and then you can draw that up into a syringe and basically spray it back over the patient's own skin. So you can get essentially an 80-to-1 mesh skin graft. So especially in the patients that have the 4-to-1 or 5-to-1 mesh, you go back over and you spray on, you know, a thin layer of keratinocytes, you're going to see a lot quicker wound healing. So that's been a really exciting development. The last thing that you can do, and this really is last resort, and we maybe do this in 1 to 2 patients a year, because these are patients that truly have no other option. You can biopsy the patient's skin, send it to a lab, and there's just one lab in the country, as far as I know, that does this. You send it to the lab, and they will grow it in Petri dishes, and after 2 or 3 weeks, they will send it back to you. This is cultured epidermal autografts, and as the name implies, it is just the epidermis, and it is the thinnest, most fragile layer of skin you will ever see. And it's miraculous because you can generate as much of it as you need, but it is thinner than the newest born baby skin and one of the most difficult things that we deal with in the burn unit, but it's absolutely life-saving.
Yeah, and I'm sure everyone can imagine, like, probably if you dropped it, you just dropped like 100 grand of like skin molecules.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And when we see the hospital bills associated with these patients, it easily gets into the millions of dollars. I mean, not only because they're in the ICU so long, but the skin substitutes are just so incredibly expensive.
How much, when you're talking about growing the skin, how much comes back to you? I'm picturing this like a bolt of fabric from the fabric store, just
like yards
skin,
rolled up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they grow it on the order of inches. I mean, I've never seen the process, but I kind of imagine that they're in individual Petri dishes because it's maybe 2 by 3 inches. And then it's on a Xeroform or Adaptic backing because the skin is so fragile that it couldn't exist on its own. So you do get a lot of skin cumulatively, but it is in very individualized package. Think, you know, it's close to Halloween, fun size. It's fun size skin.
Fun size skin. Okay.
Or like a quilt.
So you just take these little patches and you like stick them on and then peel the Adaptic off like the back of a sticker or?
Essentially. So the Adaptic stays in place for a while because the skin has to incorporate, sure. But towards day 7, after you dry them out for a little while, you pull the Adaptic backing off.
Yeah, this stuff is so wild. I mean, this is the kind of thing that is so interesting about this specialty. I mean, a lot of the cutting edge stuff in any surgical realm is really interesting, but it just seems so. Now, if anyone hasn't seen the meshes, by the way, I mean, it looks like, you know, you have a piece of skin and they've stretched out into like fishnet and you kind of lay it on people, and the idea being that you don't need to cover the complete area, it'll grow into the voids, but it, you know, you end up being able to stretch it like you would like a fishnet stocking or something like that. And people look kind of like, I don't know, fish skin, but the aesthetic part of it kind of settles out after a while, right?
And speaking of kind of pushing the boundaries, the amount of stuff they're doing now for reconstructive surgery and especially for cosmetics after the burn, they're doing some really great stuff with laser therapy to flatten scars, to get pigmentation right as well. So the nice thing is over the past 20 or 30 years, we've seen a lot better outcomes from burns. And then concomitant with that, we've had better cosmetic outcomes as well. I mean, certainly not perfect and there's a long way to go, but it's really nice to be able to offer patients who are understandably concerned about what this is going to imply cosmetically for them, to say that there is hope. You know, you don't just get out of the burn unit and then you're forgotten about. The recon and cosmetic part is a big part of what we do.
So speaking of outcomes, so what is the, what, like, does the skin, do they have problems with it long-term, or does it, like you said, just after a few weeks it grows in and that's that, and cosmetically it needs cleaning up, but otherwise it's still good skin?
They definitely have problems long-term, especially larger body surface area burns. A lot of it depends on where exactly the burn occurs. So the main issue we deal with are contractures. Any burn that's over a joint, no matter how great the graft is, things tend to heal in a little tighter than normal skin. There's also differences in scar tissue in terms of the elasticity. So for the patient that has burns over large joints, and especially if you had to do a wider mesh graft, so you have relatively more scar tissue than someone with a narrow mesh graft, you do tend to have a lot of issues with contractures. Now, we've got a great team of occupational therapists, and they do a lot of work to prevent this on the front end. But even with the most compliant patient who does all the exercises they do, often you'll have to go back in for contracture releases later on.
Talk to me about the inflammatory or SIRS response to burn, because I think this is one of the more interesting aspects of life in the burn ICU. And usually when we're dealing with inflammation elsewhere, it's a patient with an infection or something else. Mm. But in this case, it's from burn. I mean, what does that end up looking like?
So initially, it looks just like any other sort of distributive shock with massive vasodilation. The thing that makes burn interesting, though, is that you get kind of stuck in a fight or flight response. So one of the big things we deal with is burn hypermetabolism. And this is really challenging because the hallmarks of burn hypermetabolism are tachycardia and fever, even weeks into the burn. And some places say even a year out, you can still be dealing with this. So a lot of times it can masquerade as an infection. I mean, just like any other inflammatory syndrome, you can even have elements of hypotension. So when you have the patient that's tachycardic, hypotensive, and they're running a fever, the classic question, especially in the first 2 weeks, is this patient infected because they've got 60% of their skin open and we've got a central line going straight through burn tissue? Or is this patient just hypermetabolic and slightly fluid under resuscitated and it looks like infection, you know, because all the classic hallmarks you would use could manifest in either case.
Yeah, it's wild to me how long this persists. I mean, these people who like months later are still walking around persistently tachycardic and stuff, or the amount they need to eat to maintain nutrition, which some people would probably consider an upside. But how do you decide if these people do have infections? I mean, because of course they can. It's not like they're immune to that.
Well, I think like any other decision in critical care, a lot of it has to come down to what are the risk of missing something, right? And certainly the risk of missing an infection in a burn patient, certainly a bloodstream infection is going to be huge. So there are times when it's equivocal, but we go ahead and start IV antibiotics while we're waiting for culture data to cook. Procalcitonin has been useful for us recently. Not everybody is in support of it, but certainly trending it can help tell. And if you have a procal that comes back negative, you can be generally reassured, although certainly in burn, we deal with a lot of fungal infection, so it's not entirely reassuring. We do use a lot of propranolol. Propranolol is good at blunting the entirety of the hypermetabolic response. So, you know, a lot of people think of propranolol as a relatively dirty systemic drug, which in our case, we really appreciate because you're even seeing a lessening of some of the catabolic muscle turnover. So it can be a really good drug for burn patients. And if you can blunt that inflammatory response, that hypermetabolism, that'll give you a little better insight into when the patient actually is having an infection over and above that.
Right. And sometimes something we'll use in neurocritical care too for people with kind of inappropriate, you know, catecholamine storms in that situation as well. Let's at least briefly talk about nutrition. I mean, how does nutrition differ in these burn patients from the typical patient in the ICU?
It is almost impossible to get enough calories in this patient. So first off, most of the equations we use, you know, we use Harris Benedict. There's a Toronto formula. We have all sorts of ways to calculate what your protein and calorie needs are going to be, but it's almost impossible to meet those without a Dobhoff tube. You're looking at roughly 50% over your baseline, and that's for a relatively small burn. Larger burns just go up from there. So almost every patient that ends up in the ICU is going to have a Dobhoff tube placed. The two things we deal with too, every patient is always convinced that they can avoid the Dobhoff tube. They say, just tell me how many boosts I need to crush and I'll do it. But between being NPO for sedation and being NPO for the multiple trips to the operating room, and plus you just don't feel good when you have a burn, you know what I mean? And if your hands are involved, it's hard to eat. You're stuck in the ICU, so it's not like you're getting your favorite foods. It's just hospital food for weeks on end. So we really have to work with these patients to get enough calories, and almost everybody gets a Dobhoff until they are healed below 20% open body surface area. So it can be months, and they can supplement that with oral intake. But like I said, it's hard outside of a very few outliers for people to meet that much. I mean, it's Michael Phelps levels of eating in a patient that's just laying in bed, and that does not promote a whole lot of, you know, appetite.
Yeah, you haven't seen people eat until you've got them on like double tube feeds plus like meals and just like double trays, and they're still like these little slim slips of a person. And I remember, you know, seeing data that in this population, I mean, almost any restrictions or interruptions in their nutrition is associated with worse outcomes, even mortality effects. So that, I mean, it's a really a population where they'll push the idea of how little can we interrupt it. Oh, they're going to the OR. Well, let's make them NPO like 2 hours before or feed them until they're rolling out, that kind of thing. Whereas, you know, when you go to the MICU and anyone sneezes and they stop feeding you.
Yeah,
you're so right. And there's even some of the anesthesiologists that rotate through as our intensivists are more open to this. But a lot of times if the patient is not going to be prone in the operating room, they'll feed them all the way through because it's so important. And time to feed initiation is actually one of our quality metrics. So we like to get a Dapov tube placed and feeds going within 8 hours because there's research showing that, you know, gut sloughing starts to occur that quickly. And feed intolerance is a big deal. But, you know, we often have people on elemental formulations. We're really lucky. Our pharmacists that work with us in the ICU are halftime burn ICU and halftime TPN pharmacists. So in terms of tracking micronutrients or reminding you like, hey, we haven't checked a prealbumin in a couple weeks, they are so on top of it. So they are a cornerstone of our multidisciplinary team as well.
Now, a lot of people who don't spend time in this population, their immediate question when you hear stories like this, or you have that patient with 80% burns and they're on the vent with ARDS and infections every 5 days and so on, they're like, what are the outcomes like from this? I mean, surely these people do not, if they even survive, do not end up having, you know, good long-term functional outcomes. I mean, in general, what is the pie chart of outcomes look like?
So mortality, once you've reached the burn unit, is pretty low. It's about 3% nationally. And I would say that tracks pretty closely to our numbers as well. You know, one of the things I actually love about the burn ICU is generally you have patients that are younger, healthier, and more functional, especially since most of the time whatever led to the burn was, you know, industrial related or lighting a brush fire or what have you. You know, these were people that were out doing things. So the premorbid condition in these patients is actually relatively good. And so as long as you can get them through this relatively large injury, then they have decent outcomes. So I think the way to frame it is that the really big burns, the 80% TBSAs, are incredibly rare. I mean, the patients that I can think of that have survived that, I mean, they're like the top 10 in my career, you know, and they're the patients that we still text or keep up with on Facebook. I mean, those are really vanishingly rare. The patients that have 20% burns, 30% burns, for the most part, those a lot of times will not even up being life-altering injuries. You know, it is a big inconvenience. It's a, you know, month or two hospitalization, but depending on where they were burned and, you know, how much of that has to be grafted, really these people are coming back into clinic and they're, I mean, even by 2 or 3 months out, they're holding their grandbabies and they're waving and they're talking to you and they're saying, oh yeah, I got back up in the deer stand for the first time. I mean, generally just the good premorbid function gives us such an advantage. You know, I worked in the SICU as a bedside nurse, and that was one of the things I found discouraging is you could provide great critical care, but if the patient was already on a challenging trajectory, you may get them through the tough part, but then is this just a punctuated decline? You know, the counterpoint to that being the occasional liver transplant patient that you'd have that was doing better after they got in. And the thing I love about working in burn is that it feels way more like taking care of that liver transplant patient who's going through a really tough time and can be really sick, but on the other side of it is laughing and high-fiving. Or in the case of a recent patient we had, even though they had a pretty bad hand injury, was talking about the adaptive controller they just bought for their PlayStation 5. You know, like they're back into it. They're living life. I mean, it's like any disabling injury. Certainly it comes with a lot of mood changes, a lot of reintegration issues, a lot of emotional turmoil that we help them navigate, and we've got good partners that help them navigate. And there's a lot of survivor organizations that also help deal with that. But I mean, these patients are out there living life, you know, they're doing what they were doing before. And it's really cool to see.
Yeah, I feel like the most important times to learn things in a more didactic way in medicine is when they violate intuition. And it comes up in neuro and maybe in burn, where you look at a patient and intuitively you're like, this patient is not going to do, I mean, look at this. But in fact, they might. And probably a good example, like you said, of the fact that I think Hippocrates said, it's, you know, what's more important is not the injury or disease the patient has, it's the patient who has that problem. And if they're younger and healthier, and this is not like a COPD exacerbation where you treat it and they still have COPD, hopefully this person's not going to have a big burn again. I mean, anything's possible, but it's not fundamentally a recurring problem. So if they can get over it, then they may do well. Now, what I remember is, in terms of trajectories, is that, you know, some patients are not all that ill and they get out of there. And then you end up some of the really sick patients who might end up with you for like months and months. I mean, people in the ICU for like over a year, that kind of thing. Is this kind of that, I guess, biphasic distribution, the occasional just really prolonged treatment courses?
You're absolutely right. And as hospital administration constantly reminds us, our length of stay is quite long. And exactly like you said, you know, the vast majority of the patients we work with are there less than a week. People generally have pretty quick turnover. But the patients that are there for a long time are there for months.
If you have people in the audience here who are thinking about working in the burn unit, and this might apply to the bedside nurses or the docs, but I guess especially someone like an APP like yourself, what do you think are the, you know, the pros and cons of doing it in burn critical care, which is obviously different than a lot of other types of units? And of course, not everyone has even access to it, but I mean, you said maybe one pro, patients can actually do well, but I also think the burn unit can be kind of polarizing. A lot of people are like, I would never want to do that.
I had never thought I would be a burn nurse or a burn nurse practitioner to begin with. They actually invited me up to the burn unit to work as the educator many years ago. I was kind of voluntold and ended up falling in love with it, but I certainly had been one of those polarized people. I had one shift on the burn ICU as part of my training and thought to myself, I would never work there. And then, you know, 10 years later have ended up loving it so much. I think it really is something that people fall in love with. I think the thing I love most about it, so critical care is so enjoyable to me. I mean, there's nothing as satisfying than having a patient that starts out with a lactate of 8 and by the end of your shift, they're down to a lactate of 1 and they just look so good. And the oncoming shift can't believe that you've just completely transformed this patient thanks to your efforts, you know. That is so gratifying. But working in the SICU and working in the burn ICU initially, you know, if you fix a patient and then they go to step down and you never see them again, you kind of start to lose the rewards of all your efforts. So what I really like about the way our burn center is set up is that we work in the ICU, but then other weeks we'll be working on step down. And even at times we'll go cover clinic if the main clinic NP is out. So to see somebody go across that entire continuum of care and to see that the patient that you really coached to avoid high levels of opioids in the ICU is now having a much easier time on the back end because they're not on immense amounts of Dilaudid. I mean, it's very gratifying. And everything we see, even in the clinic, just goes back and informs all the interventions in the ICU. So minimizing fluid volume administration so that then the patient doesn't end up on CRRT does you a lot of favors on the back end when they're not on hemodialysis 3 times a week. So it's so great to be able to see the patients and see the outcomes of what we do in the ICU across the entire continuum of care. But that can also be challenging because, you know, the patients that maybe the rapport with the family was never great to begin with, or, you know, maybe they have serious longstanding psychiatric issues that are challenging in the ICU. You're still dealing with those 2 months later. And, you know, for better or worse, you're working with that patient until you get them to a place where they're safely able to discharge. And those psychosocial issues, they can be very, very confounding in this population.
Right. Continuity is a double-edged sword. Is the burn ICU a hot and sweaty place?
So luckily, the burn ICU, not so much. The individualized rooms sometimes, but the places they crank the thermostat up most is the hydrotherapy suite. So that's where they actually have the dressings taken down. So people often come out of there drenched in sweat. The other place is the burn OR. So basically the places where the dressings are taken down are the hottest. The burn ICU itself, the temperature is more determined by the charge nurse and how hot natured or cold natured they are, because we all know that ultimately they're in charge of the thermostat.
Yeah. I remember they had warmers that would come down from the ceiling and hover above the patients to like heat them like a panini press. I feel like a lot of the really distinctive, just experiential things in the burn ICU are maybe even apply more to the bedside nurses than to the provider teams. And this would actually probably be a good podcast to do for like nurse to nurse, because they're the ones who are in these rooms doing, you know, 10-hour dressing changes and, you know, really kind of intimately dealing with the patients and so on. They maybe even more than us, it's got to, like, you love it or hate it, I'd imagine. I can't imagine being like a SICU nurse who had to like float to the burn unit or something like that.
I think it depends. You know, there's certainly the element of Fourniers in the SICU or just your average neck fash. I mean, or even the stage 4 decubitus. I mean, there's gnarly wounds all over the hospital for sure. And I know because they always call and ask if they can transfer them to the burn unit. But, you know, our capacity is at times limited. But There's some pretty bad wounds all over. But I think you immediately know if you like to picket wounds or you don't like to picket wounds. And I think unless you have a vested interest in really cleaning up dirty wounds, burn ICU may not be for you.
Do you think it's a good environment for the PAs and MPs out there? Do you think it's a good place for APPs? I mean, a lot of our role, I think, in different types of units depends on how good of a fit in general it is. And also just who else is there. I mean, if it's a natural place for other people to work, such as other flavors of house staff and so on, or is there kind of no one else who would really be a permanent fixture and therefore you're filling that void?
I think it's a great place to be an APP. I think burn in general really is very multidisciplinary. I mean, I know we all pay lip service to the idea that like, oh, it's a great multidisciplinary team, but burn, it really is. I mean, our physical therapist, for instance, get to know things so intimately. They'll ask questions about like, hey, could we start this patient on a Presidex drip? Or like, I know other patients in this situation have gone on Remeron to help with their appetite. And you're like, gosh, you really can't help but pick up, you know, the milieu when you're just so invested in it. And our surgeons are amazing. And they really do rely on us, especially at times where it's been I've worked in institutions where there's just a burn surgeon, so they may be in surgery all day and they're relying on us to be the eyes and ears. And it is very collaborative. And by and large, the burn surgeons that I work with are incredible people, just so humble and so open to anything that I have to add. And, you know, if they think I'm off base, they'll hear me out and they'll talk through their reasoning. It's definitely a great environment to be in.
A lot of people who listen to medical podcasts are old school fans of Jeff Guy's old show, Trauma ICU Rounds? Surgical ICU Rounds. Yeah, Dennis Kim has trauma now. Yeah. He's not down there anymore, right? Yeah.
No. I mean, you're so right. Legendary figure. And when I was in the SICU as a bedside nurse, he was, you know, a rounding attending down there because I believe he covered trauma and general surgery, you know, on his non-burn weeks at that time, and certainly was legendary throughout the hospital. But before I got to the burn unit, he had started making his way up the chain, I think at HCA hospitals. And I'm not sure where he is now, but I feel like every time I hear from him or hear about him, he has moved one rung up the ladder. So probably president of the AMA here in a couple years with current trajectory. Although his daughter is an APP on the rapid response team at Vanderbilt. And as you might imagine, she's incredibly brilliant and a little intimidating, but he's still got some peripheral connection to Vanderbilt.
Brian, what else should we talk about?
This has really been fascinating. I guess you mentioned a little bit, there's criteria for transfer, but I think that's something that probably most of our listeners don't work in a burn unit, but might want to know, well, when should I call my local burn unit? Are there some good general guidelines for what needs to be sent out? Or is it more of like a, if you're uncomfortable, just call us and we'll take it off.
Absolutely. I mean, that's our guiding principle. Our number is on 24/7. Our transfer center fields a lot of calls just for consults. Like, I feel comfortable about this, but I just wanted to run it by you to make sure there's nothing that I'm missing. Mm-hmm. Our surgeons take a ton of consult calls. A lot of times too, it's, hey, I'm in this rural ED. I feel completely comfortable taking care of the burn right now, but I know they need follow-up for a variety of reasons. Can I see them now and then schedule an appointment at the burn center a week from now? So really, no burn is too small. And the criteria are incredibly broad, and they're designed that way. You're almost never going to find a burn that doesn't meet one or another criteria for at least referral to our clinic. Now, you know, inpatient criteria may be a little more stringent, but not much so. I mean, few and far between are the patients that can tolerate debridement without at least a little bit of IV pain medication. So if you think that they're going to need ongoing IV narcotics, certainly that alone is a reason for potential inpatient hospitalization. So I'd encourage everybody to look up the criteria, but even if the patient isn't meeting criteria and you just don't have a good feeling, or you feel like you need expert consultation, and especially as sophisticated as our telemedicine structures are now, I mean, it's easy, at least in the Vanderbilt system, to send pictures on over, you know, so you're not just relying on word of mouth or description of a burn that you may not be familiar with. And we're always happy to take a look at it. And as mentioned, those psychosocial factors or socioeconomic factors, you may have a patient whose burn really isn't that bad, but if they don't have access to running water, or they've got mental health comorbidities that prevent them from doing daily dressing changes or, you know, being good stewards of their burn, that's one of the things that we specialize in too. And speaking of the multidisciplinary team, our social workers are literal angels. They come down from heaven each day to work with the burn patients and then, you know, retreat back at the end of the day, because it's a tough job anywhere in the hospital, but especially on burn.
Yeah. And for anyone who maybe works in the field and is wondering when they should bring patients to the burn unit, of course, everyone has their own protocols. But I mean, the old rule, which I imagine is still true, is, you know, burn patients can be awfully sick, but it's, even initially, it's sort of unstable on the order of like hours, not minutes. So usually you can transfer. I mean, take them wherever and they can go to the burn unit. And especially if they have concomitant trauma, go to the trauma center, because they're going to bleed to death in 20 minutes. And then, you know, their burn might kill them in 24 hours. So you got to kind of deal with that thing, but don't go drive an hour to go to the burn center, you know, while they might have a hemorrhage or something like that.
You're so right. And that's one of the big cornerstones of the Advanced Burn Life Support course, is that what we know is that burns are distracting injuries. So you walk up to the MVC and you see the patient that's got 30% burns. People fixate on that so heavily that they fail to do the things that otherwise they would do. They don't check for C-spine injury. They don't check for the big splenic lack that's actually causing the patient to bleed out. You're absolutely right. This burn is not going to kill you in the short term. The burn will take hours to days to kill you, whereas the big liver lack, that's going to kill you quickly. So we know burns are distracting injuries. So stick to your ABCs. Make sure that you're taking care of the trauma first, and then the burn will take care of itself later. And off the top of my head, most of the big burn centers are associated with the level 2, level 1 trauma centers. In fact, I don't think there's very many just freestanding burn centers. I think because of the way the, you know, even just surgeon availability and the people that specialize in burns, I think you're almost always going to be taking that patient to a trauma and burn center.
Right. The more likely dilemma would be, do you skip a pure trauma center to get to your trauma burn center that's farther away or something like that?
Yeah.
What else should we talk about? Anything else you want people to take away on this sort of specialized but super interesting topic?
This is truly, nobody ever asked me about burn. And if you bring it up at a cocktail party, people are like, how quickly can I change the subject? You know, people are like, where do you work? Oh, burn ICU. And they're like, oh, I see a plate of hors d'oeuvres going by. You know what I find really interesting? Have y'all read much about cyanide toxicity?
Yeah, I mean, but it's a awfully uncommon thing to encounter.
Very uncommon.
Probably anywhere but your unit.
So, you know, now we have the patients that come in and their lactate is rising. And the obvious answer is that they're just fluid under-resuscitated. You know, common things are definitely common. But you can never see a patient with a rising lactate in the burn unit without mentioning one of two things. One, cyanide toxicity, just because it's so cool to talk about, not because it's common, but you just got to talk about it. And the other that we've started talking about recently, because we had one patient that experienced it, was type B lactic acidosis, because everybody in the burn unit gets some nebs when they cross the door. And so now everybody that sees a rising lactate, it's not the fact that the patient didn't show up until like 12 hours after their burn and they haven't gotten any fluid whatsoever. It's like, let's go searching for the zebras, you know? Because if you do identify that zebra, then you're a legend, you know?
Yeah, I mean, all the people in these structure fires and stuff, I mean, carbon monoxide and cyanide, I mean, it's not like a zebra there. And I mean, the world we live in is so gross now that anything you can see if you burn it is going to create stuff you really don't want to breathe.
Yeah, I didn't put it together, you know, using super glue in my various household projects, that it really is cyanoacrylate. You know, like when I first heard about cyanide poisoning, it's like, what is this, a 1920s detective novel? You know, like you hear about like the World War II generals with the cyanide capsules in their teeth. And then you're like, I don't really get the connection, but it has made me realize that my entire life is just pressboard furniture. And if God forbid my house went up in flames, there probably would be a lot of cyanide.
Well, I mean, one of the things that the firefighters used to say is in some ways they kind of put themselves out of business, because fires, you know, structure fires are a great example of how we've just managed to make the world safer and they just don't happen that much anymore. And I don't know if burn units were even a thing 100 years ago, but if I'm sure if they were, it was a very different world, because fires happen all the time. People got burned all the time. And now we're fortunate to be able to say that this is a kind of niche specialized thing. And compared to the people with other types of critical illness especially, it's pretty uncommon. I mean, it's 100% to the person who has the burn, but you know, on the population level, it's not so common anymore, which is a great thing. It's much better to never have these people than to have that, you know, admittedly interesting patient in your ICU for a year.
I think about public policy all the time, even things like laws about how tight fitting children's clothes have to be. I think about that a lot now that I have a 2-year-old. But you know, you see the old pictures of like the very flowing kind of like nightgown looking children's clothes. And I think everybody's heard that story about like, oh yes, your great uncle was actually lost in a fire because he was standing next to the Buck stove, which to your point even shows how things like, you know, modern ovens and not having to use a fireplace to warm your house really reduces the incidence of fires. And a lot of the outreach we do, especially in developing countries, has to do with, hey, you know, having an open fit fire in your house may be contributing to a lot of these burns. So as countries are able to develop and get modern appliances, their injury rates plummet even further. But that's a big place we target when we go to more rural areas.
Yeah, if you really look around, I mean, a lot of the world around you is influenced by fire prevention, from the, you know, number of doors in the building you're in now to what they make your mattresses out of, and probably a lot of stuff that if you're resistant to like government regulation, you'd wish were not so onerous. But I think people don't realize the alternative, which is that, I mean, you open the history book, go back 50, 100 years, every other page is about fires. Like the world is just like, it's like full of kindling, and it's really horrible. So the fact that this is kind of a thing that we have to ask about now is sort of transformative. It's maybe similar to, you know, automotive safety. And I mean, cars were just so dangerous decades ago that it was really routine for people to die and be horribly injured just by driving around. And the same idea, I mean, when you're living in like wood houses and full of particle board and you have open fires and this and that and the other, it's not weird to have a lot of burns and they get as sick as we've been describing. So, you know, while I wish that, you know, we didn't have to have fire inspections every 6 months or whatever the rules are, it is sort of for a reason. It's, you know, it's like the vaccine thing. People start to ask why we have all these shots, and it's because we've largely fixed a problem that people don't even see anymore. But it was real. And it could be again if we stop trying. Thank you so much for shedding some light on this. I hope anyone who has an interest here will give some thought to this kind of niche but very interesting specialty of critical care. We'll let you go. Just remind everyone, this is just some of our own opinions, no representation of our own institutions here. Big reminder also, if you haven't seen the Intensive Care Academy, our other project at ICU101.com, you should check it out. Tons of more educational stuff. I just finished recording a lesson on pacemakers for the ICU. And also the opportunity for continuing education credit, if that's something you need for your license or certification. I'm coming up on it myself. ICU101.com. Check it out. Talk to you guys next time.